Mendelssohn's father was Abraham Mendelssohn, and his father was Moses. Moses was a very famous philosopher, and of course Felix Mendelssohn was the famous composer. And Abraham said once, "I used to be the son of my father, now I'm the father of my son." And that's the way I feel. You know, I was a son of a very famous personality in the musical scene in Dublin, so he put it like that. And now I'm the father of a son who's died. First in the shadow of your father, and then so in the shadow of one son.
In an old German town lives an Irish cellist called Richard Grucco. Over 30 years ago, while studying music, he met a young German woman called Marlies. They married and had three children, a girl, Anna, and two sons, Ben and Kevin.
In the bush out there is the river, the Oka, which goes into the Weser, which goes into the North Sea. Oh. And it's too damp there, it's too danger of flooding. So we won't get any housing estates there.
Next to the front door is a small room lined with books.
Ben is here, he sleeps here. That's his cello, that's my cello.
Ben is his oldest son, still living.
It's nice, isn't it? It has a label in it, which is a fake, which a lot of old instruments have. Very seldom you get an old instrument with a genuine label. If they do, that's incredibly expensive. And this is probably made around the middle of the 19th century. And I bought it, 30 years ago. That's it. Well, it's been doing me fine up to now, 2 years ago. Well, it's funny to have it. A son doing exactly the same thing, or wants to do the same thing as I'm doing.
He lies the cello side by side.
That's Kevin.
Kevin is Richard's other son.
When he was tiny.
He has been dead since August 2005.
This is the so-called music room, as we call it. That's a piano which my wife inherited from an elderly lady who she gave piano lessons to. It's a Steinway from 1894. It's much too big for the room. Oh, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous instrument. I can't play. That's my wife's piano music. That's all my music here. And this here is Kevin's music. He played the trombone. That's all that stuff which he played or studied. I was on his way to it. There's not much. If you compare that, that's almost, well, I suppose half the trombone literature there is. And look at all the piano music, that's about a 20th of all the piano music there is in the world. And that's, well, quite a lot of the cello music there is, I suppose. The first thing I did after the day he died was to order his music. It was sort of a feeling of, have to do something to do with Kevin. So I ordered all his music. I don't know why, it was sort of an instinct, something very archaic. Found his music everywhere and put in order. My wife was a bit shocked by that. I mean, that was the day after he killed himself. And I just had to do something just which was connected with him. Like going out in the shed and feeling the saddle of his bicycle. That was something which you don't think about, you have the feeling you've got to go, if you can't go forward, you've got to go back. So you go back and some, like my wife, she found a pullover belonging to him and wore that, or she still sleeps with the mouthpiece from his trombone.
I stopped playing the piano. I couldn't practice anymore, I couldn't play anymore. I mean, it was hard enough to listen to my pupils, you know. And find pieces for them to play which wouldn't remind me too much of Kevin. I think for Richard it was hard enough to have to play in the orchestra. But I just stopped. Realize that he will never come back, and he will always stay 20 in our memory. He would probably look very much like Richard, his fingers as long as Richard's and his feet very long and thin, but he was full of ideas and full of interests, and but it was. It was tiring sometimes with him. Sometimes I thought, oh no, I can't go on listening to him, you know. But when it's over, you know, he would like to hear his voice again.
Du musst vorher fühlen, wo ist die Stelle, wo ich richtig was hole.
I suppose the love of music was instilled by my father. He had an amazing mind, and I admired him because I can never achieve that sort of have the intellect that he had. I think I inherited his enthusiasm for teaching. I just love teaching. It's a great contrast and extension of musical activity.
Das klingt ein bisschen gehemmt. Es ist schwer. Man hört, dass es schwer ist. Es ist nicht unsauber, es klingt so ein bisschen zaghaft.
Ja.
Auf.
Yeah, my father was a wonderfully inspired music teacher. Many ways, and he inspired lots of young people by his enthusiasm about music, which I think his grandson inherited, the enthusiasm, because I'm in between, aren't I?
Hear when Kevin was around. He was a loud voice. You'd always hear him coming up the stairs. You'd hear him coming. And he'd immediately start talking about what's just happened. Or he'd start talking about politics, why the Arabs and the Israelis are fighting against each other, something like that. And the time when his first depression came, his voice became very, very quiet. And that was always a sign he was in a bad way. And I remember talking to Ben, going round the lake here, going for a walk, where we both decided, well, do you think it's Kevin's making too much of himself or something like that? And we both sort of thinking, he's being a bit melodramatic. There was still feeling was still there, you know. So it's a dreadful feeling to have as a father of a dead son that I didn't take him serious enough soon enough. But I mean, that was our worry. How much of it is to be taken really seriously, or how much of it is just a phase? And thank goodness, I mean, my wife is a wonderful judge of personality and judge of other people's problems. She's a very good listener. She realised that was something very serious and sent him off to a psychiatrist, and he got some counselling, and that did him some good. And he came out of this first period of depression. And the last holiday we had with him together was with Ben and my wife and myself. We went off to Dresden for 2 days. And that was a wish which my wife had, well, I had as well, my wife particularly, to go to Dresden, this beautiful city on the Elbe, the Florence of the North, as they used to call it. And Kevin came with us, but he went off for a beer with Ben, and thank goodness I had the discretion to say, no, I'll go back to the hotel, and he went off with Ben. I would have liked to go with him, but I didn't, thank goodness. And they had a good time, and Ben had the feeling he'd be okay. Well, he wasn't okay, but nobody was in a position to know how serious his depression was, and his Weltschmerz, I think that's a word, which I think is in English as well. Welt is world and Schmerz is pain, the pain of the world, which I think a lot of young people and old people as well feel in the music of Mahler, this Weltschmerz.
That's something I try to avoid, to go too deep into that, you know. For instance, Mahler or Bruckner, it's just too hurtful. Bach is always good. You're always a little bit separated from the feelings, you know. I mean, he loved Mahler and he loved Bruckner, and he was playing trombone wonderful. And that music is full of of brass, and you know, you have lots of trombones and trumpets and horn, and sometimes the whole house was, you know, full of it, and we heard Bruckner from his room up to here. And I know that was the last concert he heard Mahler sixth symphony, yeah, a week before his death.
But after going to the concert of a youth orchestra playing Mahler sixth, and I'm sure that had something to do with sparking off his feeling of desolation and Todesehnsucht, yearning for death. There must have been something in that, because I know, without reading into Mahler, knowing that there's something of that in his music.
I don't think that has anything to do with his love of Mahler or Bruckner. Oh no, he was he loved life, and he was never somebody yearning for death, never.
The flat was in Hanover, where he was going to live when he was to begin his studies. But unfortunately, the other students, they were all away, so he was alone in the flat, which I think was, that time, just the wrong thing.
He got mentally ill, and it was a question of about 4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks, and that was it.
Ein Schatten fiel auf seine leuchtende Seele. I think that was a wonderful expression which Marlies found for the ceremony and for the notes in the paper. A shadow fell on his shining soul.
And what's the date there?
Well, that's when he was born, and that's when he died, 1984, 2005. He just missed his 21st birthday. Just a 19th of September was his birthday. He almost made it to 21. He wrote this letter where he says, "This is the only way out for me. When you read this, I won't be here anymore." I mean, that's sort of... he meant that seriously. He tried to, by just drinking as much alcohol as he could, to kill himself, which is, if you really want to kill yourself, that's not the right way. Okay, that's people who know about it know that, but it's the nearest thing to do without running in front of a car, which he did later. One of his friends went to the door and he opened it, and he was always in dreadful state, and they brought in the ambulance and the police came in and they brought him to hospital and pumped out his stomach, and he was okay. But because of his letter and his suicide attempt, they said he's got to be watched. They obviously had some idea of what was going on. He has to be watched, he has to be taken care of. We can't just let him out.
And we have a diary that he wrote, and the last sentence he wrote was, "Ich werde es schaffen."
What does that mean?
I will make it. Yeah, I'm trying very hard to get right again, and I will make it.
Sunday, he was taken to the hospital, and then the doctor said, "We have to take this seriously. We can't let him go out from here, because our experience is suicide attempts, which are unsuccessful, they bring with it the wish to try again, be successful. Because, of course, an unsuccessful suicide is a failure." And that's something I think which is... It's difficult for somebody outside to understand, but suicide has always got something to do with failure, one's feeling of failure in life. And so if this is a failure and it's got to be done right, at least you can get that right. Very macabre, but I think something, word of truth in that, which is the reason why they had to bring him into the closed ward in the psychiatric clinic.
Person who committed suicide was a different Kevin than he was up to maybe 4 weeks before his death. He suffered so much that he decided, "I don't want to go on living like this." And I can't understand. And it makes sense, because his life was so fantastic before that, you know, with all this music and enthusiasm and the competitions he won, and he was loved by everybody. And with this change in his brain, or whatever you would call it, his life would have been totally different, and he didn't want that. So he decided, either this fantastic life I'm looking forward to, or nothing.
One of us, or all of us, visit him every day, and he seemed to be getting better, and he was writing here, but he was very, very withdrawn, and he didn't want to be asked any question. It was a silence. We agreed with silence when we asked him anything. And he says this in his diary. Decisions are the worst. It's the worst thing that can happen to him. And that's a sort of mental illness which I think is very difficult for outsiders to believe, to accept, to understand, that somebody is in this state where he can't decide which paper he wants to have. That was part of the huge problem of deciding things. Deciding to leave home, deciding what he wants to do with his girlfriend, decide if it's the right thing to study trombone, deciding things. He's feeling this compulsion of having to think about the future, and it was pulling him down, and I think he was in this probably a state of absolute terror. I can only imagine the sort of the abyss of desperation. And that when he went out of the clinic, he was allowed to go out with either the people there or with us. He just, the fuse blew and he ran. He ran out of his life. And we were told after he ran in front of three cars until the third one hit him.
I was here, I was alone. The doctor phoned me. He just phoned me and told me that Kevin was dead. And Richard was playing, and I had to wait until Richard came back and tell him.
At that time, 7:20, I was just about to play a performance of Tosca, and I just finished a translation into English of the booklet for a CD we did of Mahler's Third Symphony, the great Mahler Third with the big trombone solo, and I just handed it over, and of all pieces, Mahler Third with the trombone solo. And then when I was off work for 2 weeks, I think, they said, you can take as much off as you need. And I think after 2 weeks, I decided to go back. And the first thing I played was Bruckner Fifth. And you wouldn't believe it, but we have always do two public performances, one Sunday morning, one Monday evening. And Sunday morning, there was a butterfly flying around. And there was a butterfly. Of course, I immediately thought something to do with Kevin. And Monday evening was still there. And a week later, we played the piece, same piece, in a church in Hillesheim, about 30 miles from here. There was a butterfly there as well. One of the proudest moments in my life was when Kevin played the trombone solo in Mozart's Requiem. And he played absolutely wonderfully. There weren't any butterflies, but I played in that church about 2 months ago, and when I was there, there was a butterfly there. Somewhere I read people's souls become butterflies, or they fly away like butterflies. That's how I felt.
I feel so much pity for him, because he must have suffered so much. I mean, just imagine being able to jump in front of a car. And actually, he did that 3 times. He missed two cars missed him. What strength he must have had, you know.
This is a mess because this was part of, well, it's where Kevin lived. It's just a mess at the moment because it was even more of a mess when he lived here. He was a terrible, messy kind of person. he never cleaned up his room. This is new. This wasn't in here. That's got nothing to do with it. That was his bed. And you get an idea of what he was interested in. Sport. He loved tennis. There was one holiday we had in the Alps when he was about 12, I suppose. And we went for an 8-hour walk, and I think he talked about 7 hours about Boris Becker.
Well, he's a real hero, Boris Becker.
Yeah. And that's Kevin. That's around the corner from the our flat in the country, in a field, there was a fun fair set up. And Ben was in one of the other gondolas, and he took a photo of him, you know, from behind him, and that's Kevin just the way he used to, he could be enthusiastic like nobody else I know. And these are posters from Amnesty International in German. And that was like his Bible. That's Mahler's second, that's Mahler's third. He was very, very interested in Mahler. And Second Symphony, I think, I remember him saying, that's the greatest piece I know. It's the greatest piece. It's where the choir comes in the end. It's a very, very moving piece. And this one has the big trombone solo, which is the trombone solo.
I could see, that a picture of Mahler? That is Mahler, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Postcard.
Yeah. That's shortly before his death. Yeah, one of his last years. Look, that's it again. There's Kevin.
Those runners, are they? They're not.
They're his, yeah. This is dust we haven't really cleaned up here since he left us. That was his main trombone is in here. And that's the little one, the alto trombone, which is high up, more difficult to play, maybe.
Do you mind taking them out, sir?
Oh, I haven't taken them out since then, but I don't mind doing so now. Doing all the dust. That's it. He had a way of expressing himself, which was his whole life was in the trombone, from the word go. They were so part of him. In fact, when he went off to a course in Italy, he was all so chaotic before. He never packed his case until the last minute. And the night before, he was much more interested in packing the trombone than anything happened to it. And so long as the trombone was in safety, everything was okay. So I think I'll pull it back again. Oh, I'll have to do this right. That's the first time I've taken that out since he died. It's okay.
It's a at the moment it's a junk room. It's full of junk. Because we haven't found the courage yet to change things. And I think there's the feeling he's going to come back, particularly at the beginning. That Scott Less had the feeling he's going to come back. It's all a hoax or something. It's going to be different. And madness by me. And I think I'm going off my head, but the thought was coming. He's going to open the door and say, "Hi, Papa." The imagination runs wild. It's what you wish most of all in the world could come true. And you know it's impossible, but you still imagine it very intensely, and so intense you feel it just maybe there's a chance that you could put the clock back or put the clock on something. It was only a mistake, but the cut, it hurts so much that you have to find a way of a chance, a hope, an illusion. Maybe we can do it differently. Hopeless illusion,
you know. When you are giving birth to your child, you know this wave is coming, and you're afraid, but it's coming and it's horrible. It's, you know, you have to go into it, and it's really very, very hurtful. And there's another one coming. You know, another wave of grief. And when it's over, it's over. And you can't imagine how it was.
It was quite impossible for my wife to play the piano after Kevin's death, because there was so much part of accompanying Kevin. And you accompany a child as well on part of his life, 20 years maybe. And to accompany one's own child musically, that's something special. In in the back of my mind, I think save that for mice as well. Will we be able to live on here in the same house where Kevin used to live? And we both thought, it's okay. And we both said instinctively, I think my wife said it first, well, it's great having pupils, because we have young people in the house that come in the house and they liven things up. And I think that survived everything, our enthusiasm, both of us, for young people.
Yes, I decided to accompany Richard's pupils for a competition. You know, and I'm going to start practicing for that, and I'm going to accompany them.
At the top of the list for a positive experience, when you've been working with somebody she's practiced a lot and she's going in for a competition, and she's the sort of person who won't be too sad if she doesn't get a prize, but got to the position where she's learnt the notes more or less, and now we're getting down to the music, and now it's just polishing, and that's wonderful. Oh, to get the people that, and then the enthusiasm, of course I get more enthusiastic, and that infects her, I think, anyway, and then it gets better, and then you have the thing, yeah, isn't that great, did you hear the sound, did you hear the way you play now? That's terrific.
Together with her, I just told myself, you have to do it, and you're going to do it, and I said, yes, I want to do it, and so I have to. Things are changing all the time, and the last stage I noticed was that I kind of suddenly heard him say, life was fantastic. Thank you. And it feels as if he had been a wonderful guest and he had to leave.
I remember him saying, what am I, my little thoughts, my little problems, compared to the dreadful things that are happening in prisons in Africa, or people being raped and being massacred in different countries of the world, people being put into prison and tortured because of their thoughts. What are my little problems in life compared to that? And that was something which I think he was possessed by, this discrepancy. I think that's the word, discrepancy. That's something I think we all go through. I can remember a similar condition of mind when I was that age. The Churchill's famous sentence, he must be a very stupid person who is not a communist by 20 and still is with 30. I mean, it was a different age, but that's put in a nutshell. What's the world cost? I can do everything now when I'm 20, and then gradually calm me down and knowing you can't change the world, but you can change maybe little things, and Ken was just starting off, but yeah, somehow he got stuck there.
You can't say you have to be sad, and you can't say you should go on. You know, there are people who say, well, life goes on, and after a year you should, you know, take your life into your hand. And but it's, no, it's every day is different. And sometimes I think I should be sad, but I'm not. And I can look at Kevin's photograph and kind of talk to him, and another day I can't. And I don't know why I'm sad one day and why I'm not sad and the other day. Because, I mean, the facts are the facts.
We don't share consciously our grieving, shall we say. We both know we've become different people, but at the same time, everything remains the same. It sounds very contradictory, but that's my experience. Life is just the same as it was before, and life is completely different.